Happy Canada Day, everyone. Welcome to the Talking BizTech. I'm your host, Sakif, and today we are going to look at the power of education. But before we do that, I just want to request all of you to make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell for more podcasts like this. And I want to thank All Innovative Solution, a digital marketing startup helping small to mid-sized businesses with their online presence. I also want to thank Revelio, which is a technological company in the Silicon Valley, who are helping entrepreneurs with software and media solutions. Now back to the topic. What is an education and why is it so powerful? Education is an act of acquiring general knowledge in order to develop the power of reasoning and judgment. Generally, it is preparing oneself or others intellectually for a matured life. The reason education is so powerful is because it gives you the ability to change your life and the lives of others. So my guest today is Firoz Alam, who is an entrepreneur, educator, and a researcher. Firoz Alam has changed his life through the power of education, and he is changing the lives of others. And he's also currently doing PhD at Guelph University. So let me just go ahead and bring him on Talking BizTech. Firoz, sir, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure to be here.
You're very welcome. And sir, before we dive into the power of education and also looking at the business, the BizTech world, I want to get to know you a little better. Can you tell me about yourself and your educational background?
Yeah, so as you have already mentioned that I'm an educator, I'm a teacher. I've been a teacher pretty much my whole life. So I was born in a small village in Bangladesh, which is the northern part of Bangladesh. And it's yes, that it's Pabna district, and it's very far from the city. Each district has a city, right? So in a very rural community. I am the first in my family to attend university. We have my parents had 11 children, so you can imagine that, you know, how... Being born in a small village in Bangladesh, in an absolutely rural community, it has given me what you have just said, you know, moments ago, that the power of education and how education could be an absolute force for somebody to get out of their current, you know, marginalization situation that is not in their advantage. So for me, education was, I would say, I didn't have any other option. I didn't have any other way out other than education. So I used education to get out of poverty, help my family. So I have been an educator now for over two decades. Right now, I am doing my PhD at the University of Guelph, but prior to starting my PhD, I have other graduate training. I've done my master's degree in development studies from Bangladesh. I have done postgraduate education degree in education. And then I've done my third graduate degree in social justice and equity studies, which is purely looking into, I usually say to my friends that, you know, if you want to get easily depressed, you should study social justice. You know, it tells you all kinds of things that is not right in the world. But it has made me humble. Because you see, I don't find it very depressing. I find it liberating.
Yes.
Because studying social justice, studying the structure of the world has afforded me to understand the world in a way I don't think I would have understood if I was purely a graduate in probably computer science or probably mathematics. So I studied heavily social science, you know, subjects like political science, philosophy, critical sociology. So that has helped me to see beyond what is apparent right in front of us.
Oh, makes sense. Makes sense. And sir, also, one thing you should know that your hometown is close to my hometown in Bangladesh. So I'm actually my dad is from Kushtia. So that's probably, and I've been to Pabna area as well. And sir, very important question that I have for you is, how did you get into the path of entrepreneurship from being an educator?
It depends on how you define entrepreneurship and what is an enterprise. So for me, I look at it this way. I usually have a very different definition for responsibility. I say that the ability to respond to life is responsibility. So being the first in my family to be a university student, I understood that for my family, for my huge family, I had no choice but to develop an entrepreneurial spirit. So from that, whatever I have done up until my life, everything had one commonality, which is like, how do you empower people through education? So I've been working on a few projects, but in all of them have rooted in one thing, that is social commitment or social responsibility. So I don't think that I set out to be an entrepreneur, and I don't call myself an entrepreneur in conventional definition, but things that I have been doing has had that goal, that in how do you empower people, particularly people who are marginalized socially, politically, economically, culturally, what have you.
Yes, that is correct, sir. And I do agree with you. Entrepreneurs are the risk taker. And also they're the ones who are changing the lives of other people. And that's what you're doing, sir. And that is a great initiative. And I hope one day I could go in that path as well. Like I'm working hard at it as well. And sir, you are also, I see that you do your podcast, and you're a podcaster. You make videos. You're a vlogger as well. I just want to know, what does a typical day look like for Firoz Alam?
So my days are pretty packed, pretty busy. So usually, what I would say that as a doctoral student, I have commitment for my research, which is pretty heavy, and as a doctoral student, you have other commitments in a way. You work as a research assistant. Sometimes you work as a session instructor. Sometimes you work as a teaching assistant. So basically, you have the loads of working as a research assistant or as an educator or the regular doctoral student's responsibilities. But other than that, what I have is I regularly work with the students of Bangladesh, especially from the remote areas, villages where I'm from. And but by the way, although I'm from Pabna, doesn't mean that my students are only from Pabna, but pretty much from many districts in
Bangladesh. Oh, yes.
From the rural areas, they participate. So I spend some time engaging in conversations with these students. So these students, they meet twice a day.
Wow.
So it means in the morning, at 7 a.m. Bangladesh time, and which is 9 a.m. Canada time, where I am located, I meet with them, and I engage in conversations with them, see where they're at. And what I try to do is, as you can imagine, that because of the COVID pandemic, the education hasn't been in a great shape in Bangladesh, particularly for those who are marginalized. I know that students who are going to private elite institutions, their education hasn't stopped, but in the villages, education has been very negatively impacted. So what I do is that I organize those young students, whether they're high school students or college students, and I facilitate, you can say, a very fully fledged functional online school. So it's like for me, It's more like I am the, you know, how in a typical day, school day, you start with the assembly, right? You know, the assembly, you know, the kids come and, you know, they start the day, right? So I set the tone for that day that what will you be learning throughout the day? So I finish, you know, for about 2 hours and then they go on, which is, you know, night in Canada, but day in Bangladesh, right? So then based on their individual activities and group activities, they go on learning different things, whether they're working with artificial intelligence, some of them are working with programming, some of them learn about, you know, machine learning or, you know, what have you, robotics and what have you. Because one of the things that we say that in during the fourth industrial revolution, we have to recognize the fact that our students, they may be educated locally, but they'll have to be competent globally. But with that, I also make it sure that they also learn about social matters. You know, Rabindranath Tagore, you know, in his education philosophy, Rabindranath Tagore is the Nobel laureate, you know, writer, philosopher, Bengali writer and philosopher, an education philosopher. And my education philosophy is hugely influenced by Rabindranath Tagore. So his vision of education was to create the citizens of the world, not essentially citizen of a district or a country or a particular belief, but the citizen of the world. So there we talk about different social issues. So that's a very important part of my day. And then they also meet, help each other to learn English. I usually say that, you know, Bangla is the language of your emotion, your soul, your emotional self, but English is the language of the economy. So these children from the villages, if they don't develop good competence in English, their careers are not going to be flourishing in so many ways. So that's one part of my day. Then obviously I go on doing a lot of research, you know, writing paper or, you know, doing my research. And my own doctoral research, doctoral dissertation is also about digital spaces. So it has got a lot of things to do with, okay, how the digital space, what's the politics behind digital space, whether, you know, it has to do with coding, whether it has to do with building a platform, whether it has to do with, you know, reading papers, writing papers, you know, so on and so forth. So my days are pretty hectic. You know, I before I realize, you know, my days are over.
It's good that you're keeping yourself busy with projects, and you're helping, like being in Canada, you're also helping people in Bangladesh. This is one advantage of technology. Can you repeat what Rabindranath Tagore says? He is a citizen of the world. Did you mention
that? So basically in his vision, in order to build a peaceful world, our educators will have to develop citizens of the world. If we indoctrinate students in a particular, I don't know whether it is a particular belief system or, you know, toxic nationalism that your nation is the greatest nation. Look at America. Look at all those countries, you know, who believe that their nation is the best nation and, you know, the consequences are not good. Yeah. So in order to build a peaceful world, we will have to be able to make citizens of the world who will be able to respect and coexist peacefully with peoples of all other countries in the world.
Oh, makes sense. It's good to learn about this because, because I was your student and also I'm still am. So I love to. I believe in the more you learn, the more you can earn. Kind of, this is the philosophy that I go with, and I'm always open minded. And I want to learn new things. And thank you so much for telling me that and sharing that as well. Sir, my next question to you is, how does the power of education affect the fourth industrial revolution? Because we are in the age of automation and robotics. Is that correct, sir?
Yeah. I mean, the power of education, I think it has to do a lot with it, particularly during the fourth industrial revolution. If you look at the prior other revolutions, let's say from the first industrial revolution to the second.
Yes.
If you look at the time or second to the third, the time difference was about 100 years. So you had a kind of social system, political system, economic system. When the economic system, political system changed, you had about 100 years to actually adjust to it, or, you know, so it's pretty much a lifetime, right?
Yes.
But, you know, with the fourth industrial revolution, the thing that is extremely challenging for any country is that we live in a time which is exponential time. Now, what does it mean, exponential time? What took place in 100 years, that happens in a couple, you know, few years now. So now, no education in the world, no particular country in the world is capable of changing, updating their education at that speed. This is just not going to happen. So in a situation like this, if you see some of the things that is happening in the machine age, so there is a amazing book I recommend everybody to read. The book is called The Humility is the New Smart. Now, if you look that book, that Humility is the New Smart, one of the core arguments of that book is that in the machine age, it's impossible. So if you look at the previous, you know, time of our education, we would actually train students to do one thing accurately. You train somebody to do one thing over and over and over again. What happens is that we become good at it. But with the machine age, what humans will never be able to do, actually beat machine in terms of actually storing and retrieving memory. So if you think about the previous time when, you know, our education was like, I train you to do one particular task. I ask you a question and you're able to produce the answer. And it's like if you have done a wonderful job and you have a guaranteed job, you go through an education system, you have a university degree, all done, wonderful. But see, in the machine age, what is happening is that machine is going to always be superior in terms of storing and retrieving memory.
Yes.
Which means that we will have to reimagine education to actually survive and thrive in the fourth industrial revolution. So what used to be a routine task, what used to be a task that is a standard, now it has to be reimagined. That how do we empower students with critical thinking? When how humility is the new smart is that now the new smart is that, you know, you can go into the zone where you don't know the answer, but if we are not humble, if we don't have that humility, we yeah. can operate in that space. So to be able to go into a space where you do not essentially know the answer, where, you know, you can be creative, you can, in the machine age, if you can actually empower yourself by a new kind of education, which is very different from previous education. So where I, as a teacher, I think that we educators will have to reimagine education if we are to help our, you know, young students. And particularly for Bangladesh, this is extremely important because we are painfully conventional when it comes to educating our students, which is all over the world. But in Bangladesh, you know, it's kind of a double whammy. So we don't teach our students to think critically, think independently, don't teach them, you know, critical thinking ability, no creativity. I'm not saying no creativity for everybody, but, you know, limited scope.
Yes, I agree. It is limited. And also, sir, you mentioned a book. I'm just making a banner. Actually, I did write it. So it's The Humility.
Humility is the New Smart. Yeah. If you just look it up, you'll be able to find it.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, no, I'm just sharing that with my viewers. Mm-hmm. And I created the banner and I did show it. So I'm just making sure that I typed it correctly. Mm-hmm. And sir, my next question, sir, you were a high school counselor.
School guidance counselor, yeah.
High school guidance counselor, right? Can you speak about the experience you had?
Yeah. And actually, you know, being a high school guidance counselor has taught me so much, and which has subsequently paved the path of doing a lot of things that I do. So, you know, where you and I are connected, then you were a student of Scholastica and I was a teacher of Scholastica. So exactly. If you think about in Bangladesh, less than 1% students of Bangladesh go to this private English medium schools. Now, I haven't gone to a private English medium school. I was born and raised in a small village. So which means growing up in a small village, growing up in an absolutely agrarian community, where agriculture is predominantly the mode of economy, survive there. So I did not understand the structural, systemic inequality in the education system, right? So if you recall that as far as my memory goes, is that every year students from these schools, our students from Scholastica, they would go to places like, Princeton, Stanford, or Oxford, or Harvard, what have you, right?
Yeah.
But then you question that, does this mean that, I don't know that every year, if I want to find out a lot of students who have gone to places like Oxford, Princeton, or Harvard from English medium schools, I don't think there'll be a shortage of examples. But if I want to find out examples, who have gone to this elite or exclusive or very dominant institutions globally from Bangla medium schools from the villages of Bangladesh, you're going to find very rare examples. So the thing is, as a high school guidance counselor, what was my job? My job was to train, to help my students to apply to the best universities. With the school money, I have, the school financed. I've gone to different conferences, leadership conferences. I remember in 2012, I went to GYLC, Global Youth Leadership Conferences, when Obama was taking office for the second time, right? So what happens that you go to these leadership conferences in different places and you meet students all over the world. As a high school teacher and subsequently also guidance counselor, I taught my students how to debate. I myself was a debater during the university. So what happens that in these institutions, when these students from English medium schools, they're being trained in how to debate, going to world debate championship competitions, going to conferences. So they learn all these skills. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have taught, I have taught students in IB, International Baccalaureate System, right? Now, think about a school, which AISD, American International School of Dhaka. In that school, a student for IB, A-levels, and I have looked up the tuition fee yearly is about 45 lakhs Dhaka. 4.5 million.
That's
so
crazy.
You tell me that kind of money, a farmer's daughter, a fisherman's daughter can't even imagine in their wildest dream. That's not so. What you see here is that the intergenerational socioeconomic inequality, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And in Bangladesh's social reality, you can see that what has happened in Bangladesh is that over the years, Bangladesh right now, the GDP growth, the economic growth in Bangladesh, in the history of Bangladesh, 50 years, it has never been so high. But at the same time in Bangladesh, the income inequality has never been so wide, what exists now. Now, as a teacher and as a researcher, I also see that how the contribution of education system, there are other factors too, but this is also, the education has a direct contribution towards it, right? Yeah. So as a high school guidance counselor, I was saying, I'm helping my students to apply to the best universities. And, I'm training my students how to write a statement of purpose. How do you write a college essay? What do you need to do to make your profile, in a way so that the university admission council is like, wow, I want this particular student. But you see, that is a kind of capital only a very handful of students have access to. Not rest of the students. Now, again, if I was not born in a village, if I did not grow up in that society, I would not understand that pain. I would not understand that inequality. And that made me feel like, what can I do to actually make this knowledge widely known for everybody? I myself, think about, you and I, we live in Canada. Now I'm an immigrant in Canada. I have my immigration done. But when I came here, I came as an international student. Yeah, thank you. So when I came to Canada, I came as an international student. Think about, University of Toronto, where an international student will have to pay about $61,000 yearly. That is only tuition fees. Now, if I go to, EFT, and I can find you dozens and dozens and dozens of students hundreds and thousands of students from Bangladesh, were coming from schools like Scholastica, you know, Aga Khan, or, you know, AISD and ISD. By the way, and you, I mean, this doesn't mean that, you know, I have something against my students. No, I am questioning the socioeconomic inequality and the intergenerational inequality, right? So from there, I understood the inequality, and I wanted to, and then I started creating videos. I created a platform called World School of Bangladesh, where the goal is anybody, irrespective of their financial background, can have access to this information. That just because you are a farmer's daughter or a fisherman's daughter, you know, your dream should not be less important to you. So that's a goal that has become my, you could say, my life's goal, something that I'm passionate about.
Now that's really good. That's a good passion to have. And sir, so you said that because it's like the university itself is very expensive to the international students. Like you said, like you mentioned, 60 grants per year. What are the ways universities can do to make it affordable to the international students besides a scholarship or a bursary? Like, what are the ways?
Thank you, Saqib. That's a question that I straddle with all the time, and it's one of my most favorite questions.
Perfect.
First of all, I don't think that universities, whether it is Canada or America, I don't think universities plan to be affordable to international students. I think what has happened, think about Canada, think about pretty much English-speaking these countries, they treat international students as their cash cows.
That's true, yes.
In business language, yeah. So when I came here as a graduate student here, I was paying tuition fees. I had scholarship. I was working as a research assistant. I was working as a teaching assistant. So I was teaching, I was researching, and I was being a graduate student. And besides, even after that, like I had to, let's say my friends were teaching two classes, one class, I was teaching two classes. I was, you know, even after that. So I was paying three times more than the local students.
So that's crazy.
That's super crazy. So then I could afford to do that because I had scholarship, I had funding, and I had a set of skills. Like, for example, I don't think if I did not teach in English medium institutions, I don't think I could so easily transfer in academic setup here, where, you know, when I'm teaching students here, I have to teach them in English. I have to be able to understand. And teaching at a, you know, university level means that you have to communicate pretty advanced ideas, you know, in a pretty much fairly comfortably. And that's not a skill that we are trained to do in Bangladesh, right? So first of all, I don't think that the university education is, the universities are trying to make it affordable. Second, I personally think from Bangladesh, I'm speaking to Bangladeshi audience, I would tell them that I don't think it's important to come to Canada to do your undergraduate degree, because, you know, doing undergraduate degrees, you don't have a lot of scholarship. But for graduate degrees, for master's and PhD, in Canadian context, students, only those who actually want to be an academic, want to go to academia, want to become a researcher. Like, for example, if you see an undergraduate degree in one program, you have 300, 400, 500 students. Like, you see an undergraduate class, you have 1,000 students, like, you know, all the departments are coming together. Yes. But in a master's program, you have 10 students, 11 students, right? So means that in the master's level, the professors need only those students who will be coming here to become trained in academia, to contribute in academia. So in Bangladesh, I would say that I encourage students of Bangladesh to aim to come to Canada for their master's and PhD studies, where they can find funding. And also the other thing is that I personally don't think it is not a good idea to come to Canada if you don't have a support system. See, I have talked to many Bangladeshi students in Canadian universities. See, when I came to Canada, I was in my 30s. I have been a teacher my whole life. I have worked so far in three different countries. So, and I have been responsible. I mean, I have contributed in my family from the age of 17. So I had a bit of emotional maturity. But even after that, coming to Canada, I understood the kind of hardship you have to go through to learn to live in a new country away from your friends and family and your support system, emotional support system.
Yes.
We think, oh, we come to Canada. You don't survive here only on bread. You need the emotional support system. So I think when, and I particularly really discourage students to come to Canada for high school degrees. Like, you know, in Bangladesh, you have seen that, you know, and to some extent, I find it that the business has become so unethical in some cases. They promote, oh, you can come to Canada for, and I have admitted students in high school in Canada. Mind you, that I was a high school guidance counselor, and I have all the things that I needed to help students to. But I personally don't support it at all. I mean, if you look it up, and I'm saying this, you know, your audience can, you know, review this,
this
part of the clip,
yes,
and they can look it up, is that in 2019, a kid named Orko committed suicide in Toronto.
Oh.
And the kid was only 12 years old or 13 years old. And in a CBC interview, what that mother said, Orko's mother said is, and she was a single mother. She said something, which is, I'm a parent too. So I know it, and I tell this as a parent, as a teacher, I say this to everybody, please understand that your child does not come to Canadian high school only as a high school student. Your child comes here and they will have to survive in the Canadian high school system. And, you know, Sakif, you and I both live in Canada, but I think you, Mane, a lot of Bangladeshis, we don't do a good job in telling the true social story of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it or not, it is a society that is predominantly, you know, favorable towards whites, not towards us. So what happened in 2019, that kid came to Canada, was going to school, he was being bullied. He came home and told his mother that, Mom, I don't want to go to school, I'm facing hardship. And you know how our South Asian mentality, right? You must go to school. You know, you are trying to be a party badge. You know, you are not doing your, you know, work properly.
Yeah, like parents want us to go to school, yeah.
Yeah, and then what happened is that after repeated being bullied repeatedly, that child, you know, jumped from the 13th floor building and committed suicide. Oh. But here's the thing, that he wrote a letter to his mother that, Mom, I've been a disappointment to you. I'm sorry. So then that mother is saying is that I should have done my research before coming to Canada. So we do not know the bullying story of Canada. Sakit, you have done university in Canada.
Yes.
In universities, you have the Bangladeshi Student Association. If a Bangladeshi student is discriminated against, if a Bangladeshi student is, you know, treated racially, that Bangladeshi student can go to Bangladeshi Student Association and can say, hey, I am treated unfairly. And then they can work together. And you know that Bangladeshi students in Canada are doing a fantastic job. They're very vocal. Like you mess with the Bangladeshi student and pretty much many other country. But in high school, you don't have it. You don't have it there.
High school is really bad. Like bullies.
Yeah. Yeah, so I say that when a student has just finished high school in Bangladesh and then come to Canada without having a family support system, without having, like, you know, friends and families, it's not easy. It is hard. It is hard. But in Bangladesh, our parents, like, I'm a parent, I'm saying from that point, we have a mentality. Oh, my son has gone to Canada and my son is pursuing his degree in University of Waterloo Computer Science. She is studying at University of Toronto. Bhai, hold on to your horses. You know, your pride is not actually helping so much. So it's money. It's their mental health. It's understanding that, you know, we don't survive on bread only. You know, you need a support system. You know that old saying that you need a village to raise a kid? That still applies when you're going to university.
Yes. Yes. And sir, so I live in Waterloo, like, but I didn't go to University of Waterloo, but I went to Wilfrid Laurier University, but what I heard that when I was at university, I heard that Waterloo University, many engineering students are also committing suicide because there's an intense pressure of passing the program. And, you know, like it's really, really, it's very challenging and hard to pass the program itself. And sir, I have a quick question for you. you are helping many kids from poor family come to Canada and United States of America. You're helping them earn scholarship. How are you doing that? Like, can you tell me about the journey? And is there an organization that's helping you as well?
So basically, I do two things. One of the things that I do, you know, and that goes in, again, into the background of the history that, you know, when I was working in the English medium schools and then subsequently, you know, high school as a high school guidance counselor, I know the, you know, tricks of the trade that basically why somebody gets scholarship and how to actually, why a profile becomes important, right? So yes. Then what happened, I have created two different, I have led the foundation of two different platforms. One is World School of Bangladesh. So World School of Bangladesh is an online platform that aims to provide quality education to all Bangladeshi students, irrespective of their financial background. Yes. So the goal is there, we train students, you know, whether it is critical thinking, you know, mm-hmm. how to, because you see, in order to get a scholarship, we should be able to think critically. In order to get a scholarship, like let's say I work almost on a regular basis, you know, somebody who's applying here for the university and they'll reach out to me saying, sir, how do I write a statement of purpose? So I know how to write a statement of purpose, or somebody will send me their, you know, research proposal and I'll go over it and I'll give them suggestion, feedback that, okay, maybe you can change this, you can change this. I'll just tell you a simple trick that from Bangladesh, if I see, I'm not financially very rich. I'm not powerful. I'm not minister of a country. So if it were up to me, I would make this program's national program, not because, you know, I want to be in the program. No, I want to make this public knowledge. I want to, you know, I used to teach economics. So, you know, in economics, there is a term, it's called imperfect information. In a market, when the customers, the clients, the consumers, they have perfect information, then the producers cannot cheat them. It's like, oh, I'm selling something to Saqif at $10, but I'll sell something to James at $15. I can't do it because you both know what's exactly the price, right? In education, the same thing is happening. Like my family members, because I have been a guidance counselor, I have been a high school teacher, I have been, you know, a teacher for over two decades. My family members, they will easily know the tricks of the trade, that basically how to write something, how to actually do it, right? So, you know, so what I do, I hope I will let your audience know through our conversation that when from Bangladesh somebody is looking to how to get a scholarship, I tell them this simple three-step process. If you're a student of a particular, let's say that you are a student of sociology or anthropology or computer science, what have you, right? Okay, you want to go to University of Waterloo. And you go to the university website and see what each of the professors are researching. Mm-hmm. Computer science is a vast field. Somebody is probably researching with, you know, AI and algorithmic justice. Somebody's, you know, find out that which professor is researching what and what is their areas of interest. Find that out. And find out in which area your interest, something that you're passionate about, actually works, right? So right now I'm working with a student in Bangladesh. She's a young woman, she's a computer science major. She's interested in, you know, how programs can be made in a way so that the justice is provided for women. So, you know, so there you see gender and computer, there's intersection here, right? So obviously there are so many professors who are working in that field. So find out that what professors are researching and which professor's research connects with your interest, number one. Number two is that under the professor, the students who have completed their master's and PhD, find out what is their, you know, dissertation topic, their thesis topic, that what they have done in the research, right? And see, get to know the student's profile. Now, where are that student from? You know, why they have chosen a particular topic? Ask yourself the simple questions, right? I mean, in Bangladesh, we have a huge problem. I have heard this from many, many, many students. They tell me, sir, I don't know what to research. I don't know, you know, what topic should I choose? I said, you don't have to know. First, go and see what other people are researching. From there, oh, I know this area. And which is in Bangladesh is a huge gap in education. Second, third, Professors give you money from their funding. Professors get funding. They get Shark funding, NSERC funding, you know, Tri-Council funding. There are so many different kinds of funding. So professors want to hire masters or PhD student because they have gotten a grant funding. And from that grant funding, they give you the money, right? So see whether a professor has funding. You might like a professor's research area, but they may not have funding to give you, right? So if these three, if I could, if I had it my way, Saqib, I'd go to National Television of Bangladesh and I would teach the whole damn country, please follow this three-step process. Now, I'll tell you, I did not know this when I was a student of, you know, being a Bangla media student, I didn't know this information. Most students in Bangladesh, like more than right now, 30 lakh, more than, you know, 3 million students in Bangla media in national university, they don't know this information. So the goal of World School of Bangladesh is actually make this information open to everybody so that it's not the only the students of Scholastica or AISD, they know this information. It should be available to everybody, right? So that's one. Second thing that I do is that in order to think critically, independently, that is a deficit that is not only in Bangladesh, it's all over the country, all over the world, all over the world. So I have a platform which is called Canada Bangladesh Social Justice Action Research Alliance. It's a big name.
That
Canada Bangladesh means I am now an Bangladeshi immigrant in Canada. So by paper, I'm an immigrant. So I have the rights here. I mean, I wasn't born here. I have earned it through the process, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I was born and raised in Bangladesh. Yeah. So that's the primary connection of Canada Bangladesh. But all these conversations that I do there, it has one common connection, which is social justice. But then I call it action research. Easiest way to understand action research, when a research is actually used to bring social change. Not, okay, I have done a research, I have done in my dissertation, my doctorate degree is earned, papers is published, and dissertation is done, and now I'm Dr. Saqib. No, not that. Is your research actually contributing to improve society? That's action research.
Yes.
So being a graduate of social justice and equity studies, being involved in the social justice, you know, scenes in Canada. Mm-hmm. When I first came to Canada, you know, in 2014, I was a steward for international graduate students. I saw at the universities that how do you promote the rights of international graduate students, you know, in the university. I have gone to conference like RISE, Racialized and Indigenous Student Experience in Canada, where I understand that in Canadian universities, white students are way more privileged than black and people of color, Indigenous students.
That's
and
true.
You see, I see these things unapologetically. I enjoy lots of benefits from Canada, being an immigrant here, having that right.
Yeah.
But I don't feel hesitant. I unapologetically speak about the systemic discrimination in Canada.
Yes.
That what does it mean? To be white, like just, you know, less than a month ago in London, you live in Waterloo, and a Muslim family was, you know, brutally murdered. What was their crime? Because they're Muslims. Just yesterday, you know, another 182 unmarked graves have been found in British Columbia, Indigenous students, right? So I speak them unapologetically. So in the social justice, this Canada-Bangladesh Social Justice Action Research Alliance, I talk with the professors, researchers, scholars, community leaders, member of parliaments, politicians, you know, from all over the world. So what happens is that when I discuss with them, mm-hmm. I see that how their research can make us think critically.
Yes.
So the students of Bangladesh from the villages, from, you know, the marginalized background, they don't have access to these professors. They don't have access to these community leaders. I can talk to a member of parliament in Canada easily, but, you know, a Bangladeshi kid from a village in Bangladesh cannot do that.
Yeah.
So in that case, what I can do, I can ask that member of parliament difficult questions.
Yes.
And I present Canada, not a sanitized version. I present it through brutal examination of sociology. So what happens, it helps students. Now you tell me, if you can train a student from village how to think critically, if you give them the tool, that's it, that's a hack. And yeah. my goal, basically I said that vision 2030, that my goal is that by 2030, I want to help at least 10,000 students from the villages, not in the city, Sakib. I make it very, you know, not from the marginal, not from the privileged family. Like I have taught in over 20 years, thousands upon thousands of students.
Yeah.
But you see, I want to help the kids, young students, whose father, whose mother, they don't have the financial ability, but, you know, give them the information. When they will make it to these universities, if they want to, should they choose to, not that they have to. Let's say when a farmer's daughter make it to Harvard, then I'll say, okay. So that's the goal that I work towards.
And that's why I want to collaborate with you, because mm-hmm. I want to help you in best possible way, because I believe, like my friend Tanzim, who I introduced you to, and who opened a school in Uttara, and he's helping underprivileged kids, right? And also, sir, you can speak your mind. That's the beauty of podcasts. Like mm-hmm. you have that freedom, and you can speak your mind. And also, here, sir, very quick question. See, with the technology. Taking our attention, like our attention is a commodity to technological companies. So I want to know how technological companies can reduce the attention engineering, and also what's your thought on future education?
Yeah. So basically, my doctoral dissertation is in the area that where digital spaces, your emotion,
yes,
is actually weaponized with disinformation. I make you angry. I show you everything that is fundamentally wrong. And you become so angry that you stick to the phone, right? So yes. You see, I say it this way, that you are giving 8 to 10 hours of your day to Facebook. You're working for Facebook, but not getting paid for it. So it's free labor. Yeah. So again, your audience can, you know, hear this conversation and get back to this book. So a professor of Columbia University, his name is Tim Wu. He has written a book, it's called Attention Merchant. So there, Professor Wu shows that how your attention is sold by the technology companies. Attention is the most profitable commodity in the world at the moment. But here's the thing, Sakib, and that's the tricky thing. Nothing in your life has happened for your progress where you had the command over your attention. You want to learn something? You have to use your attention.
Yes.
So, you know how in Bangla we say to our kids, hey, monojog diye porashona korona, monojog diye porashona korona, right? So we tell our kids, pay attention to your studies, but do we tell them that how not billions, trillions of dollars have been invested to distract them?
No, we don't tell them that, no.
No, we don't. So there you see people, technology ethicists like Tristan Harris, or, you know, world-renowned historian like Yuval Noah Harari, or, you know, technology guru like Jaron Lanier coming and telling you that, oh my God. You know what's fascinating? The Silicon Valley gurus who are the, you know, the rock stars of Silicon, like Steve Jobs or, you know, Bill Gates and all of those.
Yeah.
They don't give their children technology in their hand. And I read an interview, I was like, oh my God, Steve Jobs really? Was asked a question that, how does your daughter like iPad? And Steve Jobs said, I don't give her the iPad. She's not allowed to have an iPad. So the thing is, these kids, they go in the midst of nature.
Yeah.
They learn very human skill. Professor Sherry Turkle from MIT, she has written not one, two, three books. Is that how our children are failing to hold a meaningful conversation with other children? Because in order to be able to communicate with somebody, you should be able to read them emotionally. You should be able to connect with somebody emotionally. You can't, we don't know. Our kids are more comfortable sending text. And our entire life has become a performed life in social media, where I'm always laughing, I'm never sad, everything in life is beautiful, I only have, you know, the best hair days. Now, this is crazy. This edited performance of life is destroying. And what's happening? Our kids are thinking, only my life is sad, only my life is bad. Everybody else's life in social media looks good. And therefore, our children are learning to hate themselves because everybody's skin is brighter than mine. Everybody has biceps and abs. Our boys are growing up with toxic masculinity because if I'm not as masculine as John Abraham, or I don't know when all that stupid examples, and I apologize for using their language. Yeah. So whether it is attention, mm-hmm. whether it is shaping our psyche, these technology companies are simply causing a different kind of pandemic. Intellectual, spiritual, emotional pandemic, destroying, yep. sabotaging the psyche and emotional health of our children. So I, again, don't think that the technology companies are actually going to address it because their business model mm-hmm. is this. And this is why I told you in the beginning that I don't think that I'm an entrepreneur in so-called conventional sense. Whatever I do it out of the sense of responsibilities that I question myself, what have I been doing for my children, for yes. my brothers and sisters, from my family members? What have I been doing? So what I do for my son, I want to do that for the whole country, for the whole world, you know, for the marginalized communities. And here's the thing though, Saqib, you know, there's one beautiful sentence that follow the money.
What is it?
So basically in English, they say that, you know, if you want to understand something, follow the money, that where the money actually is.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, I heard
follow the money. Yeah. So you can go and check my life. You see that whether I own a huge mansion or do I drive a Mercedes, and you know, that's what's my life is. But you see, when I say follow them, I'm just a doctoral student. I'm a full-time researcher. I'm a teacher. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't own a mansion in Bangladesh. I don't have a building. I don't own a car. But that doesn't bother me at all. But here's the thing, though. When you see incredibly powerful man like Mark Zuckerberg going on to news media and saying, and he's going there wearing just a, you know, simple t-shirt and, you know, just a jeans and, you know, appearing to be, I'm just like you, Saqib. You're wearing a t-shirt, I'm wearing a t-shirt too. That is dangerously deceptive.
Yes.
And these company owners, they say sentences like, oh, we want to make the world a big family. We want to connect the world. But by connecting, how they're sabotaging, destroying mm-hmm. our emotional life, our spiritual life, our psychological, you know, state, they don't take accountability. So I don't think that these companies will actually take accountability, because their money, their business depends yes. on capitalizing, selling our attention.
So it's then it has to be on our end, right? Like, how parents control their kids, or how individuals, like my friend Ryan, who barely goes to social media sites. Like he deactivated his Facebook. He hates Instagram. And so, and we're not almost near the end, sir. My last question to you is, do you have any tips and advice for people who are struggling financially in this pandemic?
So basically, I thought, in my thoughts about people who are struggling financially. Mm-hmm. So I again, as an economics teacher, I say this, is that take a look at a branch of economics. It's called Buddhist economics, right? Mm-hmm. So basically, we think, I mean, and again, as an economics teacher, I'm telling you this, that we teach our students downright blatant lies as economics teachers. We teach our students that utility or benefit of your life or your well-being depends on how much you consume. Oh, Saqib, how much you're happy? You know, whether you consume a lot, you know, do you have 200 pairs of shoes or, you know, I don't know, 5,000 t-shirts and all that, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So basically, we teach our students lies that help the companies, that help the capitalist companies. So during the pandemic, I request pretty much everybody to question that, see that what really impacts your well-being, what has been helping your well-being in your life. You see that it's a relationship. And I say this again, that it's connected financially, very, and you know, look it up, that the longest research in the world on happiness has been done by Harvard University, where they have been collecting data for the past 84 years. I don't think any other university in the world would have that amount of funding or support to be able to conduct a study for 84 years. So they have followed people for the longest time. They have followed people in the, you know, poor neighborhood of America, you know, the black people, the inner cities, you know, the ghettos, right? And yes. Rich people who have gone to Stanford, Princeton, or Harvard, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So that long study have concluded three things, that what makes people fundamentally happy.
Yes.
The quality of your relationship.
Yes.
In Facebook, you have 5,000 friends, but in reality, quality-wise, you probably don't have five friends.
Yeah,
so it's not the spread, it's the depth.
Yeah.
So the kind of relationship that people have, that depends the happiness of their life. Number two.
Sorry for cutting you off. You mean the fake friends, right?
The fake friends, exactly. The fake friends, or we assume we perform friendship, but actually we friendship is something that we do. It's not essentially, oh, I am Saqib's friend. Is that, what have I done to actually respect this friendship? And you and I living in Canada, I think we can learn from Indigenous people.
Yes.
Indigenous peoples teach that you start your relation by breaking breads. When I say breaking breads, it means that, you know, by living a life of solidarity in action. So so that's the thing, that what's the kind of relationship that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Second is that whatever you do, whether you are a teacher, whether you're an entrepreneur, whatever you do things that has deep meaning to you? Purpose. You know,
like having a purpose.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even it is in religious text, don't do something that does not, you know, give you joy. You know, so just because your father has said you to become an engineer or BCS officer because, you know, that will give you a lot of money, but you are utterly miserable doing it, don't do it. So relationship, the work that you do, what meaning that it holds for you.
Yes.
And third, do you actually spend time to understand yourself? In all these three things, you will not see that none of them are dependent on how much money you have. But yes, the money that you have, that you need, your minimal need. You see, in economics, the first thing we teach is the difference between need and want. Need is something without what you can't live. Oxygen, food, that's need. But want is unlimited. So Buddhist economics teaches you that actually question that what actually maximizes your well-being. So people who are struggling financially, I'll tell you that actually to become rich, there are two ways. Make yourself utterly miserable, go after material things, become utterly lonely and do more and more possession and become sad. And that is why, you know, teaching our kids to be selfish and competitive is a recipe for disaster, because our kids become very competitive and successful in their result, but inside mm-hmm. they're very lonely and sad. So yes. Loneliness is the biggest crisis in the world, by the way, biggest public health crisis. So you can do that, or you can actually question that, how little do I need? What is it that I absolutely need? I just need two pairs of sandals. I freaking don't need to wear a Rolex. You know, I teach, I'm sorry, Saqib, I'll just give you this one example. That, you know,
yeah, go for it.
So basically, as I told you that I teach, kids from very marginalized backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So one day I was teaching, some kids from a slum in Bangladesh, and I was teaching them, how there are different kinds of things, that are very expensive, that are very, and all of that. So I was telling one of the students that, there's a kind of watch, it's called Rolex. It's extremely expensive. You need 5 lakh taka, 10 lakh taka, 5 lakhs, 10 lakhs taka to buy this watch. And only the rich people can, buy this watch. And this little girl in my class, she was telling me, sir, does it give the same time as a cheap watch? It hit me like 40,000 volt. I was thinking, oh my God, this girl has taught me such an invaluable lesson. So are you interested to wear a Rolex and make yourself utterly miserable? Or you can literally buy a watch with $5, man. You don't, what are you going after? I mean, okay, you are wearing, Louis Vuitton or George Armani? Doing what? Do you see? So I don't know, probably I have, grown older. Probably I have, fallen flat on my faces many times, failed miserably. So that probably has taught me a lot of things which I did not know. I mean, in my early 20s or late teens, I also wanted to look poshy or shiny. But now I am completely content walking down the street wearing a plastic sandal. I couldn't care less if somebody wears a Louis Vuitton, like, okay. If somebody drives a Ferrari, like, okay, fine. I personally feel kind of sometimes sad that this person is so craving. Have you seen somebody drives car in the street and I don't know what they do? They do something and the car makes a lot of noise.
Yeah. Those Hummer, they have a weird sound. And yeah. Sir, what you just shared, the takeaway from that is that failure is the pillar of success. Is that correct?
Failure can teach you a lot of things, which success can make you proud. And I think I have seen in my life, again, being a teacher, that a lot of my students who have done exceptionally well in their academic career are some of the most miserable people I know. Because they have defined their sense of self with success, that I have been always an A grade student. So as a father, I teach my son, learn to fail gracefully. I tell my son that I guarantee you that you will fail. I guarantee you that you will fail. So, I tell my son that please don't be the center of your existence, because if you become the center of your existence, you will be utterly lonely. And loneliness will simply, and by the way, when I say this, there is a book by a professor in the University of Chicago. His name is John Cacioppo. The book is called Loneliness. If you smoke 47 cigarettes a day, the kind of negative impact it will have on your health, loneliness does that kind of thing. So loneliness literally kills you.
Yes.
It's not a metaphor, literally kills you. And loneliness is the biggest public health crisis in the whole world right now.
Yes.
It's not some kind of, this or that. Loneliness. People are dying of loneliness. So what am I teaching my son? To build relationship or becoming competitive, narcissistic? Being a father of a son, I know that how crazy it is that, we teach our boys particularly all the toxic things. What's your bicep? Do you have 8-packs? Do you have a Hummer? Or, it's like, who has the shiniest toys, right?
Yeah.
Oh, no. That's the recipe for disaster. And as a teacher, again, teaching the richest kids in Bangladesh, I have seen there are two kinds of poverty. One is material poverty. Mm-hmm. The other one is mental poverty. Mental poverty is far too dangerous than material poverty. Sorry, I went on a rant, but this is what I feel as a teacher.
Sir, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for sharing the knowledge, your insight, and the amazing stories. Actually, more than amazing. They're inspiring. And also, I wish nothing but the best for you and your goals, as well as World School of your educational institution, World School of Bangladesh. I hope you can meet your goal by 2030. And also, I watch your podcast on Facebook. So let me just create the banner. It's a long name, but I do love that you have an abbreviation for it, CBS Jara. Definitely. And sir, so thank you so much for everything. And I would love to have you on Talking BizTech again, because I want to your stories. I learned a lot from your stories. And also getting out of your comfort zone, or like you said, make mistakes. And then I also believe that depression comes from this loneliness. So again, sir, thank you so much, and have a wonderful day, sir.
You too. Take care. Bye.
And you're very welcome, sir.
Thank you. Bye.
Folks, thank you so much for tuning in to Talking BizTech. Do not forget to subscribe and hit the notification bell for more podcasts like this. And if you want to purchase the Revelio membership, the link is down in the description box. And thank you so much, and have a wonderful day.